The Younger Edda, in prose, was written down by one Snorri Sturluson in the last part of the 12th century. The chief part of it is a technical treatise on how to write poetry, but it also contains some prehistoric mythological material which is not in the Elder Edda. The Elder Edda is much the more important of the two. It is made up of separate poems, often about the same story, but never connected with each other. The material for a great epic is there, as great as the Iliad, perhaps even greater, but no poet came to work it over, as Homer did the early stories which preceded the Iliad. There was no man of genius in the Northland to weld the poems into a whole and make it a thing of beauty and power. No one even to discard the crude and the commonplace and cut out the childish and wearisome repetitions. There are lists of names in the Edda which sometimes run on unbroken for pages. Nevertheless, the somber grandeur of the stories comes through, in spite of the style. Perhaps no one should speak of the style who cannot read ancient Norse, but all the translations are so alike in being singularly awkward and involved that one cannot but suspect the original of being responsible, at least in part. The poets of the Elder Edda seem to have had conceptions greater than their skill to put them into words. Many of the stories are splendid. There are none to equal them in Greek mythology, except those retold by the tragic poets. All the best northern tales are tragic, about men and women who go steadfastly forward to meet death, often deliberately choose it, even plan it long beforehand. The only light in the darkness is heroism. Chapter 22. The Stories of Signy and Sigurd. I have selected these two stories to tell because they seem to me to present better than any other the Norse character and the Norse point of view. Sigurd is the most famous of Norse heroes. His story is largely that of the hero of the Nibelungenlied, Siegfried. He plays the chief part in the Volsunga saga, the Norse version of the German tale which Wagner's operas have made familiar. I have not gone to it, however, for my story, but to the Elder Edda, where the love and death of Sigurd and Brunhild and Gudrun are the subject of a number of the poems. The sagas, all prose tales, are of later date. Signy's story is told only in the Volsunga saga. Signy was the daughter of Volsung and the sister of Sigmund. Her husband slew Volsung by treachery and captured his sons. One by one he chained them at night to where the wolves would find them and devour them. When the last, who was Sigmund, was brought out and chained, Signy had devised a way to save him. She freed him, and the two took a vow to avenge their father and brothers. Signy determined that Sigmund should have one of their own blood to help him, and she visited him in disguise and spent 3 nights with him. He never knew who she was. When the boy who was born of their union was of an age to leave her, she sent him to Sigmund, and the two lived together until the lad, his name was Sinfjotli, was grown to manhood. All this time, Signy was living with her husband, bearing him children, showing him nothing of the one burning desire in her heart to take vengeance upon him. The day for it came at last. Sigmund and Sinfjotli surprised the household. They killed Signy's other children. They shut her husband in the house and set fire to it. Signy watched them with never a word. When all was done, she told them that they had gloriously avenged the dead. And with that, she entered the burning dwelling and died there. Through the years, while she had waited, she had planned, when she killed her husband, to die with him. Clytemnestra would fade beside her if there had been a Norse Aeschylus to write her story. The story of Siegfried is so familiar that that of his Norse prototype, Sigurd, can be briefly told. Brunhild, a Valkyrie, has disobeyed Odin and is punished by being put to sleep until some man shall wake her. She begs that he who comes to her shall be one whose heart knows no fear, and Odin surrounds her couch with flaming fire, which only a hero would brave. Sigurd, the son of Sigmund, does the deed. He forces his horse through the flames and wakens Brunhild, who gives herself to him joyfully because he has proved his valor in reaching her. Some days later, he leaves her in the same fire-ringed place. Sigurd goes to the home of the Gjukungs, where he swears brotherhood with the king, Gunnar. Grimhild, Gunnar's mother, wants Sigurd for her daughter, Gudrun, and gives him a magic potion which makes him forget Brunhild. He marries Gudrun, then, assuming through Grimhild's magical power the appearance of Gunnar, he rides through the flames again to win Brunhild for Gunnar, who is not hero enough to do this himself. Sigurd spends 3 nights there with her, but he places his sword between them in the bed. Brunhild goes with him to the Gjukungs, where Sigurd takes his own shape again, but without Brunhild's knowledge. She marries Gunnar, believing that Sigurd was faithless to her, and that Gunnar had ridden through the flames for her. In a quarrel with Gudrun, she learns the truth, and she plans her revenge. She tells Gunnar that Sigurd broke his oath to him, that he really possessed her those 3 nights when he declared that his sword lay between them, and that unless Gunnar kills Sigurd, she will leave him. Gunnar himself cannot kill Sigurd because of the oath of brotherhood he has sworn, but he persuades his younger brother to slay Sigurd in his sleep. And Gudrun wakes to find her husband's blood flowing over her. Then Brunhild laughed, only once with all her heart, when she heard the wail of Gudrun. But although, or because, she brought about his death, she will not live when Sigurd is dead. She says to her husband, "One alone of all I loved, I never had a changing heart." She tells him that Sigurd had not been false to his oath when he rode through the fiery ring to win her for Gunnar. "In one bed together we slept, as if he had been my brother. Ever with grief and all too long are men and women born in the world." She kills herself, praying that her body shall be laid on the funeral pyre with Sigurd's. Beside his body, Gudrun sits in silence. She cannot speak, she cannot weep. They fear that her heart will break unless she can find relief, and one by one the women tell her of their own grief, the bitterest pain each had ever borne. "Husband, daughters, sisters, brothers," one says, "all were taken from me, and still I live." Yet for her grief, Gudrun could not weep, so hard was her heart by the hero's body. "My 7 sons fell in the southern land," another says, "and my husband, too, all 8 in battle. I decked with my own hands the bodies for the grave. 1 half year brought me this to bear, and no one came to comfort me." Yet for her grief, Gudrun could not weep. So hard was her heart by the hero's body. Then, one wiser than the rest lifts the shroud from the dead. She laid his well-loved head on the knees of his wife. "Look on him thou loved, and press thy lips to his, as if he still were living." Only once did Gudrun look. She saw his hair all clotted with blood, his blinded eyes that had been so bright. Then she bent and bowed her head, and her tears ran down like drops of rain. Such are the early Norse stories. Man is born to sorrow as the sparks fly upward. To live is to suffer, and the only solution of the problem of life is to suffer with courage. Sigurd, on his way to Brunhild the first time, meets a wise man and asks him what his fate shall be. "Hide nothing from me, however hard." The wise man answers, Thou knowest that I will not lie. Never shalt thou be stained by baseness. Yet a day of doom shall come upon thee, a day of wrath and a day of anguish. But ever remember, ruler of men, that fortune lies in the hero's life, and a nobler man shall never live beneath the sun than Sigurd. Chapter 23. The Norse Gods. No god of Greece could be heroic. All the Olympians were immortal and invincible. They could never feel the glow of courage. They could never defy danger. When they fought, they were sure of victory, and no harm could ever come near them. It was different in Asgard. The giants, whose city was Jotunheim, were the active, persistent enemies of the Aesir, as the gods were called. And they not only were an ever-present danger, but knew that in the end, complete victory was assured to them. This knowledge was heavy on the hearts of all the dwellers in Asgard, but it weighed heaviest on their chief and ruler, Odin. Like Zeus, Odin was the Sky Father, clad in a cloud-gray kirtle and a hood as blue as the sky. But there the resemblance ends. It would be hard to conceive anything less like the Zeus of Homer than Odin. He is a strange and solemn figure, always aloof. Even when he sits at the feasts of the gods in his golden palace, Glatzheim, or with the heroes in Valhalla, he eats nothing. The food set before him, he gives to the two wolves who crouch at his feet. On his shoulders perch two ravens, who fly each day through the world and bring him back news of all that men do. The name of the one is Thought, Hugin, and of the other, Memory, Munin. While the other gods feasted, Odin pondered on what Thought and Memory taught him. He had the responsibility, more than all the other gods together, of postponing as long as possible the day of doom, Ragnarok, when heaven and earth would be destroyed. He was the All-Father, supreme among gods and men, yet even so he constantly sought for more wisdom. He went down to the Well of Wisdom, guarded by Mimir the Wise, to beg for a draught from it, and when Mimir answered that he must pay for it with one of his eyes, he consented to lose the eye. He won the knowledge of the runes, too, by suffering. The runes were magical inscriptions, immensely powerful for him who could inscribe them on anything, wood, metal, stone. Odin learned them at the cost of mysterious pain. He says in the Elder Edda that he hung 9 whole nights on a wind-rocked tree, wounded with a spear. I was offered to Odin, myself to myself, on that tree of which no man knows. He passed the hard-won knowledge on to men. They too were able to use the runes to protect themselves. He imperiled his life again to take away from the giants the Skaldic mead, which made anyone who tasted it a poet. This good gift he bestowed upon men as well as upon the gods. In all ways, he was mankind's benefactor. Maidens were his attendants, the Valkyries. They waited on the table in Asgard and kept the drinking horns full, but their chief task was to go to the battlefield and decide at Odin's bidding who should win and who should die, and carry the brave dead to Odin. Val means slain, and the Valkyries were the choosers of the slain. And the place to which they brought the heroes was the hall of the slain, Valhalla. In battle, the hero doomed to die would see maidens excellent in beauty, riding their steeds in shining armor, solemn and deep in thought, with their white hands beckoning. Wednesday is, of course, Odin's day. The southern form of his name was Woden. Of the other gods, only five were important. Balder, Thor, Freyr, Heimdall, and Tyr. Balder was the most beloved of the gods, on earth as in heaven. His death was the first of the disasters which fell upon the gods. One night he was troubled with dreams which seemed to foretell some great danger to him. When his mother, Frigga, the wife of Odin, heard this, she determined to protect him from the least chance of danger. She went through the world and exacted an oath from everything, all things with life and without life, never to do him harm. But Odin still feared. He rode down to Niflheim, the world of the dead, where he found the dwelling of Hela, or Hel, the goddess of the dead, all decked out in festal array. A wise woman told him for whom the house had been made ready. The mead has been brewed for Balder. The hope of the high gods has gone. Odin knew then that Balder must die. But the other gods believed that Frigga had made him safe. They played a game, accordingly, which gave them much pleasure. They would try to hit Balder, to throw a stone at him, or hurl a dart, or shoot an arrow, or strike him with a sword, but always the weapons fell short of him, or rolled harmlessly away. Nothing would hurt Balder. He seemed raised above them by this strange exemption, and all honored him for it, except one only, Loki. He was not a god, but the son of a giant, and wherever he came, trouble followed. He continually involved the gods in difficulties and dangers, but he was allowed to come freely to Asgard because, for some reason never explained, Odin had sworn brotherhood with him. He always hated the good, and he was jealous of Balder. He determined to do his best to find some way of injuring him. He went to Frigga disguised as a woman and entered into talk with her. Frigga told him of her journey to ensure Balder's safety and how everything had sworn to do him no harm. "Except for one little shrub," she said, "the mistletoe, so insignificant she had passed it by." That was enough for Loki. He got the mistletoe and went with it to where the gods were amusing themselves. Hodur, Baldur's brother, who was blind, sat apart. "Why not join in the game?" asked Loki. "Blind as I am," said Hodur. "And with nothing to throw at Balder, either." "Oh, do your part," Loki said. "Here is a twig. Throw it, and I will direct your aim." Hodur took the mistletoe and hurled it with all his strength. Under Loki's guidance, it sped to Balder and pierced his heart. Balder fell to the ground, dead. His mother refused even then to give up hope. Frigga cried out to the gods for a volunteer to go down to Hela and try to ransom Balder. Hermod, one of her sons, offered himself. Odin gave him his horse, Sleipnir, and he sped down to Niflheim. The others prepared the funeral. They built a lofty pyre on a great ship, and there they laid Balder's body. Nanna, his wife, went to look at it for the last time. Her heart broke, and she fell to the deck, dead. Her body was placed beside his. Then the pyre was kindled, and the ship pushed from the shore. As it sailed out to sea, the flames leaped up and wrapped it in fire. When Hermod reached Hela with the gods' petition, she answered that she would give Balder back if it were proved to her that all, everywhere, mourned for him. But if one thing or one living creature refused to weep for him, she would keep him. The gods dispatched messengers everywhere to ask all creation to shed tears so that Balder could be redeemed from death. They met with no refusal. Heaven and earth and everything therein wept willingly for the beloved god. The messengers, rejoicing, started back to carry the news to the gods. Then, almost at the end of their journey, they came upon a giantess. and all the sorrow of the world was turned to futility, for she refused to weep. "Only dry tears will you get from me," she said mockingly. "I had no good from Balder, nor will I give him good." So Hela kept her dead. Loki was punished. The gods seized him and bound him in a deep cavern. Above his head a serpent was placed, so that its venom fell upon his face, causing him unutterable pain. But his wife, Sigyn, came to help him. She took her place at his side and caught the venom in a cup. Even so, whenever she had to empty the cup, and the poison fell on him, though but for a moment, his agony was so intense that his convulsions shook the earth. Of the three other great gods, Thor was the thunder god, for whom Thursday is named, the strongest of the Æsir. Freyr cared for the fruits of the earth. Heimdall was the warder of Bifröst, the rainbow bridge which led to Asgard. Tyr was the god of war, for whom Tuesday, once Tyr's Day, was named. In Asgard, goddesses were not as important as they were in Olympus. No one among the Norse goddesses is comparable to Athena, and only two are really notable. Frigga, Odin's wife, for whom some say Friday is named, was reputed to be very wise, but she was also very silent, and she told no one, not even Odin, what she knew. She is a vague figure, oftenest depicted at her spinning wheel, where the threads she spins are of gold, but what she spins them for is a secret. Freya was the goddess of love and beauty, but strangely to our ideas, half of those slain in battle were hers. Odin's Valkyries could carry only half to Valhalla. Freya herself rode to the battlefield and claimed her share of the dead, and to the Norse poets, that was a natural and fitting office for the goddess of love. Friday is generally held to have been named for her. But there was one realm which was handed over to the solid rule of a goddess. The kingdom of death was Hela's. No god had any authority there, not Odin even. Asgard the Golden belonged to the gods, glorious Valhalla to the heroes. Midgard was the battlefield for men, not the business of women. Gudrun, in the Elder Edda, says, "The fierceness of men rules the fate of women." The cold, pale world of the shadowy dead was woman's sphere in Norse mythology. The Creation. In the Elder Edda, a wise woman says, "Of old there was nothing, nor sand, nor sea, nor cool waves, no earth, no heaven above, only the yawning chasm. The sun knew not her dwelling, nor the moon his realm. The stars had not their places." But the chasm, tremendous though it was, did not extend everywhere. Far to the north was Niflheim, the cold realm of death, and far to the south was Muspelheim, the land of fire. From Niflheim, 12 rivers poured, which flowed into the chasm, and freezing there, filled it slowly up with ice. From Muspelheim came fiery clouds that turned the ice to mist. Drops of water fell from the mist, and out of them there were formed the Frost Maidens and Ymir, the first giant. His son was Odin's father, whose mother and wife were Frost Maidens. Odin and his two brothers killed Ymir. They made the earth and sky from him, the sea from his blood, the earth from his body, the heavens from his skull. They took sparks from Muspelheim and placed them in the sky as the sun, moon, and stars. The earth was round and encircled by the sea. A great wall which the gods built out of Ymir's eyebrows defended the place where mankind was to live. The space within was called Midgard. Here the first man and woman were created from trees, the man from an ash, the woman from an elm. They were the parents of all mankind. In the world were also dwarfs, ugly creatures, but masterly craftsmen who lived under the earth, and elves, lovely sprites who tended the flowers and streams. A wondrous ash tree, Yggdrasil, supported the universe. It struck its roots through the worlds. Three roots there are to Yggdrasil. Hell lives beneath the first, beneath the second, the frost giants, and men beneath the third. It is also said that one of the roots goes up to Asgard. Beside this root was a well of white water, Urda's well, so holy that none might drink of it. The three Norns guarded it, who allot their lives to the sons of men and assign to them their fate. The three were Urda, the past, Verdandi, the present, and Skuld, the future. Here, each day, the gods came, passing over the quivering rainbow bridge to sit beside the well and pass judgment on the deeds of men. Another well, beneath another root, was the well of knowledge, guarded by Mimir the Wise. Over Yggdrasil, as over Asgard, hung the threat of destruction. Like the gods, it was doomed to die. A serpent and his brood gnawed continually at the root beside Niflheim, Hel's home. Someday they would succeed in killing the tree, and the universe would come crashing down. The frost giants and the mountain giants, who lived in Jotunheim, were the enemies of all that is good. They were the brutal powers of earth, and, in the inevitable contest between them and the divine powers of heaven, brute force would conquer. The gods are doomed, and the end is death. But such a belief is contrary to the deepest conviction of the human spirit, that good is stronger than evil. Even these sternly hopeless Norsemen, whose daily life in their icy land through the black winters was a perpetual challenge to heroism, saw a faraway light break through the darkness. There is a prophecy in the Elder Edda, singularly like the Book of Revelation, that after the defeat of the gods, when the sun turns black, earth sinks in the sea, the hot stars fall from the sky, and fire leaps high about heaven itself, there would be a new heaven and a new earth. In wondrous beauty once again, the dwellings roofed with gold, the fields unsowed bear ripened fruit in happiness forevermore. Then would come the reign of one who was higher even than Odin and beyond the reach of evil. A greater than all. But I dare not ever to speak his name, and there are few who can see beyond the moment when Odin falls. This vision of a happiness infinitely remote seems a thin sustenance against despair, but it was the only hope the Eddas afforded. The Norse wisdom. Another view of the Norse character, oddly unlike its heroic aspect, is also given prominence in the Elder Edda. There are several collections of wise sayings, which not only do not reflect heroism at all, but give a view of life which dispenses with it. This Norse wisdom literature is far less profound than the Hebrew Book of Proverbs. Indeed, it rarely deserves to have the great word wisdom applied to it. But the Norsemen who created it had, at any rate, a large store of good sense, a striking contrast to the uncompromising spirit of the hero. Like the writers of Proverbs, the authors seem old. They are men of experience who have meditated on human affairs. Once, no doubt, they were heroes, but now they have retired from battlefields and they see things from a different point of view. Sometimes, they even look at life with a touch of humor. There lies less good than most believe in ale for mortal men. A man knows nothing if he knows not that wealth oft begets an ape. A coward thinks he will live forever if only he can shun warfare. Tell one your thoughts, but beware of two. All know what is known to three. A silly man lies awake all night thinking of many things. When the morning comes, he is worn with care, and his trouble is just as it was. Some show a shrewd knowledge of human nature. A paltry man and poor of mind is he who mocks at all things. Brave men can live well anywhere. A coward dreads all things. Now and then they are cheerful, almost light-hearted. I once was young and traveled alone. I met another and thought myself rich. Man is the joy of man. Be a friend to your friend. Give him laughter for laughter. To a good friend's house, the path is straight, though he is far away. A surprisingly tolerant spirit appears occasionally. No man has nothing but misery, let him be never so sick. To this one, his sons are a joy, and to that, his kin, to another, his wealth, and to yet another, the good he has done. In a maiden's words, let no man place faith, nor in what a woman says, but I know men and women both. Men's minds are unstable toward women. None so good that he has no faults, none so wicked that he is worth naught. There is real depth of insight sometimes. Moderately wise each one should be, not overwise, for a wise man's heart is seldom glad. Cattle die, and kindred die. We also die. But I know one thing that never dies, judgment on each one dead. Two lines near the end of the most important of the collections show wisdom. The mind knows only what lies near the heart. Along with their truly awe-inspiring heroism, these men of the North had delightful common sense. The combination seems impossible, but the poems are here to prove it. By race, we are connected with the Norse. Our culture goes back to the Greeks. Norse mythology and Greek mythology together give a clear picture of what the people were like, from whom comes a major part of our spiritual and intellectual inheritance.
This has been a Hachette audio production of Mythology, Timeless Tales of Gods and Heroes, written by Edith Hamilton, read by Suzanne Torin, produced by Michelle McGonigal, directed by Graham Malcolm, recorded by Tommy Herron, post-production by Tim McCarthy. Mythology is also available in print and as an ebook from Little Brown & Company, a division of Hachette Book Group. Text copyright 1942 by Edith Hamilton. Copyright renewed 1969 by Dorian Fielding Reed and Doris Fielding Reed. Audio production copyright 2013 by Hachette Audio. All rights reserved. In accordance with the U.S. Copyright Act of 1976, the duplicating, uploading, and electronic sharing of any part of this audiobook without the permission of the publisher is unlawful piracy and theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like to use material from the audiobook, other than for review purposes, prior written permission must be obtained by contacting the publisher at permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights.